Unless I'm mistaken, in order to win the Nobel Prize in physics, your hypotheses have to be proven correct in your lifetime. Is that correct? Only can and only once your hypothesis is proven. Einstein predicted that light would bend around the light of the gravity of a star, and I think it was only after an eclipse that someone was actually able to make this observation. Am I remembering? I don't think he got the Nobel. Yeah, but
yeah.
We're going somewhere else. It's really okay. It's really okay. Mathematicians whose work precedes any sort of practical application of their mathematics, often by decades. I think it's very difficult in a life to understand that most of what we do is planting seeds that will sprout not at our control. I started to get a little sad a few minutes ago. I was reading the commentary from this week's parasha by Kalonymous Kalman Shapira, who was the Warsaw Ghetto Rebbe. At the end of the war, his sermons, probably collected by his students, were buried in a milk jug, kind that Tevye would have used. I thought about, there's no guarantee that anyone would have found that, or it would have survived the war, could have been hit by a bomb. Or that it would mean a lot to me. His writings mean a lot to me and to many others. He couldn't have known that. There's one of my favorite stories in the Talmud is about Rabbi Zera, who was small and deformed. I picture him having spinal bifida. And he used to go around and speak to these ruffians in his neighborhood, and the other sages would mock his efforts. This is all in two lines in the Talmud. It tells a world of a story. And he died, and the ruffian said, "We ought to repent, because it used to be that this small burned one was praying for us, and now there's no one left to pray for us. We have to do it ourselves." Which gives a lot of messages, but one of them being that Rabbi Zera never saw the effects of his work. My rabbi, Dan Shevitz, would say that the effect of sermons is cumulative. No single sermon really matters, but it's the effect of weeks and years of sermon giving that really calls people out Jewishly. And I think about, as I mentioned before, our play space, which was at least two, if not more, years in the making, and certainly more years than that before I knew people well enough to find out how it could happen. You know, one of the deficits for Heskamuna is that it hasn't had long-standing rabbis who can build that network of relationships to get certain things done. And it's hard, my work. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think teachers experience this, physicians, physicists. It's nice to have a job like an engineer or a bricklayer where you can see your work take shape. But I know for Karen, as an environmental engineer, the effects of her work are decades in coming. There's a lot of images in our tradition of how we would plant seeds. I want to start with the first and a very queer image. There are a lot of strange images in our Torah that make you pause and think, you know, with some tens of thousands of verses in the Torah, why did they bother to include this one? So we have two verses this week about carrying a trenching implement and using a latrine in your camp. You know, that was worth including in Deuteronomy. It is an important thing in terms of siege works and long-term travel. In the developing world, having a latrine actually is a significant goal that Peace Corps volunteers will work on, or a lot of development corporations will work on, because latrine building reduces greatly the incidences of dysenteries and typhus. But it's interesting that they should describe the trenching implement in this whole verse of our Sefer Torah. So I think, like all the things I'm going to share with you today, it's about planting seeds. It's about cultivating a sensibility that may outlast the act. I think in that case, it's about a sense of cleanliness and sacredness in the camp that is demonstrated in details. That the place where we live, the place where we worship God in the wilderness, for example, and around the tabernacle, is a place that needs to be maintained aesthetically, at the very least. That it shouldn't smell foul. That our living spaces and our lives generally should be cultivated, should be purified, should be, that fastidiousness is a kind of spiritual discipline, both literal and metaphorical. And I think what I'm getting at about planting seeds is illustrated in a midrash, a line from midrash, that Rav, one of the great sages, said that the mitzvot were only given for the refinement of creation, literally to heat them up almost, to burn them, to put them in a crucible, is the word he uses. But that's why we have Jewish practices. It's not to put on the tefillin, it's not to not eat milk and meat. That's the outcome is actually a sensibility about what you eat. The outcome is an awareness of God through your own body. That I have taught people, I've talked to people, you know, people ask, where does this mitzvah come from? And there are verses you can point to in Torah and you can point to historic precedents. But I think the more interesting question for me is, where does this mitzvah lead us? What is its goal? What does it take us to? We get another really strange passage toward the end of the parsha about Amalek, who assaulted the Israelites during their voyages. We see that in, I think it was in Exodus, and picked out the laggards, like a lion against wildebeests. And we're told to remember Amalek and to blot Amalek out and to not forget in a very short sequence. What is that there to cultivate? A sense of historic memory and grievance? Maybe not, but a sense of history, a sense of patterns, a sense of the dangers of evil and forgetting, a sense that some things must be razed, R-A-Z-E-D, that they must be leveled before we can build again. All of these pieces of verses and all of these mitzvot, I think, are there to refine our spirits, to make us more holy. As I've said in writing, it's like gym for your spirit, that mitzvot are there to, just as you would lift weights, not just to lift weights, but so that you can do a sport, so that if someone were stealing someone's purse, you could run after them. You're prepared, to use Hemingway's idea. You prepare yourself for the work to come. Another weird mitzvah, I mean, I just picked up the weird ones in this week's parasha, is Shiluach HaKein, which I think was in your parasha, it was in one of the early middle readings, that when you see a nest, you don't take the mother bird and the eggs, you don't take the mother bird and the young, you don't consume them together, you keep the mother bird away from the act. And it's one of the two places in Torah that it says that will extend your life. The other one being practicing awe and reverence to your parents. You know, my kids aren't here, but and it's too late for them also. But I think this is really a great mitzvah because all of our sages kind of struggle with this when it seems so odd and trivial. But I don't think it's trivial. I think the tent peg is weird and it's hard to make homily out of it, hard to make understanding out of it. I don't think this one is so trivial. I think Nachmanides, in the Middle Ages, says that it's to cultivate a heart of compassion. I think that's obvious. There's a great Israeli movie about 10, 15 years ago. I think it's called My Father, My Lord. And there's a scene of the father doing this. And there's a scene in Talmud of someone watching this be done, and then the person dies thereafter. The challenge being the verse that it will continue to lengthen your life might not pay off, but I think it's a really beautiful mitzvah to take care of something in its nest. You know, we all hear that if you touch the young, the mother won't come back to them. I don't think that's entirely true, but it's not true, not at all. I didn't think it was at all true. Maybe with one species it happened once. But I think the point is to treat all living things with care, to be compassionate upon our fellows, to be compassionate upon, as Pastor Chris Battle would say, the last, the lost, and the least. You know? The Katav Sofer in the 19th century says, this implants in our hearts the virtue of mercy on each and every creation, and if you fulfill this mitzvah, you become one of the merciful, even if you are not predisposed to be. And then we have mitzvot in the parasha, commandments, issues, principles that are, they're sort of more obvious even to our day. The principles of labor and labor relations, payment, HR. The HR department of the Torah is in this week. I hate making sort of kitschy comments like that, but that's more or less what it is. It's human resources. How do we treat our human resources? So among the things we're taught when you deal with a laborer or a debtor, you have to take some, collect a debt, there are certain things you can't do because they would be too onerous to the person in debt. So you can't take the upper millstone. And if you look in your Eitz Chaim at some other time on page 1129, it gives a great description of how this worked. So you had a lower millstone, which was this heavy volcanic basalt. Basalt, is that how you pronounce that word? B-A-S-A-L-T? Basalt? It's basaltic rock, but it's basalt is the thing. Which was about 90 pounds, but you had an upper millstone that was to grind things between that was lighter. And you could, that could be popped off and taken. And there obviously was a practice that until you pay me back, you can't have that. But among other things, you can't enter a person's house. You can't sleep in a garment that he lends you, much like that that verse from Talmud I told you. When you have someone's thing, you can't use it for your own sake. You have to return their pledges. You have to pay wages to a laborer on the same day. Implication being that there are limits to debts we can collect. There's a concept in our tradition called lifnim mishurat adin, which is, in English we say to go beyond the letter of the law. In Hebrew it actually means to stay within the letter of law. Meaning I could collect on you all $1,000, but that might render you destitute. So lifnim mishurat adin, I don't enact or exact my full recompense. Merchant of Venice would be a good counterexample. You don't get to do all these things. You don't get to treat other people with as objects, as vehicles for your own gratification and self-aggrandizement. That, as Kant would say, people always have to be the ends and not the means. The Sefer Chinuch, one of my favorite writings from the Middle Ages, which is somewhere between a law code and an ethical will offered to a grandson, says, with the comment about paying the wages on the same day, it's not appropriate, since the laborer is fed by his own wages, that he doesn't have sums of money, he has no wealth. He lives on a day-to-day payment for, you know, grain every day. It's not appropriate to delay his feeding because for the poor, he carries his spirit upon him, meaning he lives day by day. That even when we think about our own needs, we're not entitled to violate the needs of others. We're not entitled to treat them as objects. And I think most clearly when we look at the planting of seeds, you know, I think the Torah is here to give us encouragement in our own work. As I said, maybe if you're an engineer or a bricklayer or a writer, well, no, not for a writer, you get to see results. But even for a novelist, you never know who's going to read your book and what it's going to mean to them. Even in jobs where you get to see the results, even if you're a Frank Gehry, you never know what the experience of a better example, Le Corbusier has a building in Boston that's part of our arts center at Harvard. And he couldn't have known when he designed it, I would guess 50 to 70 years ago, that I would love walking through it every day, that it would inspire me in a strange way. I mean, it's a very strange building. So even if you see the thing built, you don't really know its outcome. I think Torah is there to give us these mitzvot, knowing that Moses, as he gives them over, doesn't know what's going to happen. He knows he's planting seeds. So I want to leave you with some of the last ones, mostly through Rashi, our 11th century commentator. So in the poverty of another person, when you find someone's animal, it says you can't hitalem. You can't make yourself disappear, is literally, which is to say you can't pretend you didn't see the problem. And Rashi says, translates that or glosses that as lichbosh. You can't conquer your own vision. You can't come over your own perspective and pretend you don't see the pain. Pretend you don't see another's difficulty. We're told not to flog someone to excess in their punishment, lest that fellow, your brother, your sister, be degraded. And Rashi says, even if you call someone wicked all day long, this is a great comment for our own political age, don't forget that they're your brother. And when I wrote that down, I didn't think about the political perspective, but my rabbi also, to return to him, would say that conservative Judaism is there to cultivate passionate moderates, a very rare breed. I think That's all a part of it. Don't forget other people's distress. Don't close your eyes to the suffering of the innocent. Don't pretend that people you disagree with are not your brothers. Don't pretend that people who are incarcerated aren't your brothers. They are more than their crime. Don't pretend that people who are drug addicts are not your brothers and sisters. Don't look away. Don't look askance. Cultivate compassion. Let those seeds be planted and sown. Lev's taken to teaching the preschool kids Peter, Paul, and Mary song. What do we do when we needed corn? The dreamer. Plowed and we sowed. You're sowing. You're just sowing seeds in your own heart, in the hearts of others. You never know. You never know at the end of your life, like Rabbi Zera, whether your work will have meant anything. Most cases, as I look around the room and look at you, I know your work will mean something that will transcend you. But that's what faith is the not knowing and the doing it anyway.